From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Regina Resnick. After four decades as a member of the Metropolitan Opera, Resnick is now on Broadway, co-starring in the revival of Cabaret. Also today, I talk with pianist and composer Rand Blake, who heads the third stream department at the New England Conservatory of Music. Two new albums and a new reissue show off his idiosyncratic music. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators, the Texas band that proved you didn't have to be from California to play acid rock. And humorist Alice Kahn comments on the travails and triumphs of moving. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Regina Resnick is proving that it is possible for an opera star to give a thrilling performance in a Broadway show. For over 40 years, Resnick was a member of the Metropolitan Opera and sang in many of Europe's finest opera houses. She is now co-starring in the Broadway revival of Cabaret, the musical set in Germany at the dawn of Hitler's rise to power. The revival stars Joel Grey, who reprises the role that he played in the original Broadway production and in the film. Resnick plays Fräulein Schneider, a Gentile woman who runs a boarding house and falls in love with her Jewish boarder. In the original Broadway production, Fräulein Schneider was played by Lotte Lenya. The role was cut from the film version of Cabaret. I spoke to Regina Resnick from the NPR Bureau in New York. As of yet, there is no cast album of the revival of Cabaret, but I want you to hear this 1961 recording of Regina Resnick singing an aria from Carmen. Carmen is one of the roles she is best known for in the opera world. Regina Resnick, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Can I ask you to compare the physical sensation of singing opera and doing the kind of singing you're doing now on Broadway?
Well, it's a different technique. It's another way to reach the audience. It's a change of voice. It's that, how can I explain, cutting back your instrument to suit the size of a theater, to suit the style of the music that you're singing, and then to realize, of course, that you're being mic'd, and to give the amount that you really think will equalize yourself with the other members of the show. It's both technical and artistic, and certainly vocal. I changed an entire way of singing in order to do Cabaret, which had nothing to do with my operatic voice. Actually, I hardly use, with the exception of some sounds, I hardly ever used the sounds that people had heard me sing for 40 years.
Are you singing from a different part of your body?
Oh, no. The vocal cords are the same. The throat is the same. The body is the same. The technique is the same.
Is the singing you're doing in Cabaret closer to your speaking range?
Actually, the good part of the part and the way John Kander and I organized the songs is that I'm particularly pleased that when I sing, I sound the way I speak. And the voices are very close. My speaking voice and the singing voice in Cabaret are quite close. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the opera, you never really would understand what my speaking voice was like unless I had lines to speak, which I did have in the opera, by the way. I sang Orlovsky in the Fledermaus, where I tried to approximate my speaking voice to my singing voice, even though the part lay higher than my own speaking voice. And then I sang The Daughter of the Regiment, in which I had an entire act of French spoken dialogue, really a la Comédie Française, in which I tried to approximate my speaking voice also to match my singing voice. Aside from that, I never had the challenge because actually nobody heard me speak on the operatic stage. They heard me only sing.
That's interesting. You had been retired from opera for a few years before you were called on to do cabaret.
I was never retired from anything. I never used the word retired.
Why not?
Well, I never made any farewells. I never said I wasn't going to do anything anymore. I didn't say this was finished. The book was closed. I felt that I was doing an ongoing life, which was artistic, and decided that the operatic stage that I had known possibly since the war, the finest years that the operatic world and the concert world knew, and that it was the correct moment to withdraw from certain parts, which I had done over a period of 4 or 5 years, leaving certain parts wide open, things I knew I could sing the rest of my life if I were called on to do so. As a matter of fact, here's an interesting little tidbit. As I started working on Cabaret with Hal Prince last January, he asked me if in the season 88-89 would I like to sing Peak Dom if he directed it. So here we were talking about possibly going back to the opera with Hal Prince. Oh. You see, so I didn't really retire. I decided that after 40 or 41 years on the operatic stage, there were other worlds to conquer. And so I announced no retirement, no farewells, and just put myself in quasi-limbo. Turned out to be very busy producing a film, which you may know about, which was shown on PBS called The Ghetto of Venice, and going into another project, and then busying myself a great deal for almost 2 years with young talented singers in various master seminars for singing, like the Mozarteum in Salzburg, Royal Conservatory in Canada, etc.
You didn't audition for Cabaret. You were called. How did that happen?
Well, I did not audition. I did read for Hal Prince. I really do not know exactly the story in the ensuing weeks just before I was called, but I do understand that a great many actresses, including some very fine names, Broadway names, read for the part. What I heard was that they couldn't sing, and that many good readings were there, but there was no question about voice. There was just no one who could sing the part. And then the Hal Prince office called the Kurt Weill Foundation, which is a highly interesting organization that was created by the Last Will and Testament of Lotte Lenya in honor of Kurt Weill, the director of which is Lise Simonette, with whom I had a lovely conversation just yesterday. She said to Ruth Mitchell, if I were to cast the part today, there really is only one person. I haven't got a clue as to whether she's interested, so why don't you call her? And so Ruth Mitchell, who is Hal Prince's right arm, called me and said, would you be interested, and would you come, and would you read, and would you look at the music? I was rather taken aback by it. It came as a complete surprise. I met Hal. I read for 5 minutes. I never sang for them, and the rest was up to me.
What did you read? As you pointed out, you weren't very used to doing lines on stage.
I had never read an audition. I had never had a script in my hand where I had to sit with the director and just off the top of my head, think what the scene was like without someone telling me what it was all about. I read through the script the night before, and I knew that the next day they'd say, turn to page 7, because I heard that that's the kind of thing one does with actresses. So I turned to page 7 and read, and that was it.
What was the passage that you read? Do you remember?
The very, very first entrance of Schneider, when she's selling the room to Mr. Bradshaw.
There were probably a lot of other things you had to get used to performing on Broadway, things that you weren't used to from the opera world. Even Broadway customs. Were there Broadway customs that you had to get acquainted with?
I don't think so. Customs in what sense?
Well, I don't know. It just seems to me that the world of Broadway has its whole set of rules by which they operate. That's probably pretty different from the world of opera. Even the way you take bows is probably different on Broadway.
Well, the bows are arranged, in any case, by the director, whatever performance you do, whether it's the operatic stage or whether it's the Broadway stage. The big concerted bow, which I call the company bow, is traditional everywhere, and then solo bows. So the way the director chooses to do it is not a different custom. It's just the way it's chosen to be done. Very often in the opera, we also took our bows in the set. But traditionally, they were usually done in front of the gold curtain. The solo bows, the curtain came down, and then the stars came before what we called the bow curtain or the solo curtain or the gold curtain, whatever it was. But that's not so terribly different. The only thing that I find, which is enormously taxing and truly different, are the rigors of the schedule. Because I, you see, even at the maximum and at the very outside, I wouldn't sing more than three times a week, and that was quite taxing in the repertory which I did. I mean, if people who were singing secondary parts or walk-on parts in the opera were called on to do truly almost what Broadway people do. They are on practically every night or four or five times a week or six times a week. With the repertory that I sang, it was not even possible to sing more than two Carmens and one Electra in 1 week. And even that was unusual. Twice a week was much more the norm of the very big operas which I sang.
In your role in Cabaret, you play a Gentile woman who runs a boarding house and falls in love with and is ready to marry one of her boarders, who is a Jewish man.
Correct.
And then as the Nazis are gaining power, she decides this is not a good idea for her to marry the Jewish man. And she sings a song basically telling him so. What did you have in your background that you could draw on to sympathize with this woman who is turning aside her lover because he is Jewish?
Good question. And you hit something which really I haven't publicized too much. I think I really spoke to only one journalist about it. It was the following. Actually, she doesn't turn her back on anything. She is a pragmatic person who says in her song and in her big speech, which is really the major dramatic speech of the piece at the very end, her farewell, she tells why she has survived and how she has fought to survive alone, and that living alone is a habit that's hard to change, and that she still wants to survive and has chosen what she thinks would be the safe way for her to survive and still live alone. The relation to me was very strange because some years ago, I would say 8 years ago, I had the occasion to visit the Soviet Union, and being of Jewish origin, myself and my entire family that was left in the Soviet Union, the majority of whom are still there, because my father and mother were the only two of their families that came out. And as my father's family was practically entirely exterminated by Hitler's march on the Eastern Front into the Ukraine, and my mother's family suffered a great deal, many of them never did get away or come back because they had been sent to other cities to relive their lives, etc. One cousin, actually my father's nephew, I found in the Soviet Union, and we had a very interesting meeting, a supper, when I was there. And my husband and I were doing Falstaff in Warsaw as a production for the Grand Opera in Warsaw, and we had the opportunity to fly into Soviet Russia for 10 days. And I met him, and this is long before Cabaret, but actually at supper he almost gave me word for word Schneider's speech. And I said to him, Pyotr, which is Russian for Peter, don't you want to come out and start a new life? And he said the following to me. You see your aunt sitting there, your father's sister? She's old and sick. And in her childhood, she could never go to school, being Jewish, and neither did your father. Now she's being taken care of by the government, and her illness is being cured, and she will live her life out without my worrying about her old age and whether she'll be taken care of. I have a 12-year-old son who has an education free. I'm a hairdresser at the Bolshoi. I'm 54 years old. My wife is 55 years old. She's the foreman of a Klieg-like factory that manufactures a lot of the products for the Bolshoi. Soon she will be able to retire, take care of our son, and do the things she wants. What choice do I have? Said he to me. These are Schneider's words. In her speech, she said, after all, in the end, what choice do I have? What he was saying to me is that at my point in my life, if I make a change, I really do not know what will happen to me. So I asked him, what is his liberty worth as Jew or as a human being? He said, we all make sacrifices. Deep in my heart, I know what I am. My son will know what he is. And we will make the accommodation to survive because we've grown up in a certain way that has given us more than we ever had and more than our parents ever had.
You think it would have been hard for you to understand your character if you hadn't heard him say those words?
No, not really. I have to tell you another reason why. This is going to sound a little perfunctory after this more profound speech that I told you about my cousin in the Soviet Union. An actor or an actress does not have to relate to what she does. Many people became astounded that they found me as an actress in cabaret, but I prided myself my entire life on being an actress on the operatic stage, the difference being that I used my operatic voice as a singing voice to portray what I did. But what did I have to do with Clytemnestra, with which I became identified? My name, Regina, is Queen, and Reznik in Russian is a butcher. And so when I played Clytemnestra, I was the queen butcher. So if you want to call that a relationship to a part, the woman who axed her husband in the bathtub in the great trilogy of Sophocles, what did I have to do with Carmen? Really, I had almost nothing to do with anything I ever sang. What I had to do with it is that I was doing my craft.
Right, acting.
And my
right.
trade, acting. So therefore, the question that my cousin Peter did give me a little bit of insight into survival of why people stay and don't go was, let us say, an insight. But I don't think it would have made me play Schneider any differently. I saw her. I saw perhaps the plight of the person who wanted to survive and make a choice a little more poignantly. But I must say the way Kander and Ebb and Joe Masteroff wrote it, the part is so marvelously written, and her part especially is so succinct. I don't think there's a word or a note in it that's too much. They really didn't give me such a difficult task, I must say.
Well, I want to speak with you more about your acting and your singing. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Regina Reznik, who is performing on Broadway in the revival of Cabaret. For over 40 years, she sang on the operatic stage. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Regina Reznik, and I want to play for you another one of her recordings. This was recorded in 1961, and she's performing Princess Eboli's aria from Don Carlos. listening to the voice of my guest, Regina Resnick. Let's talk about your singing. Something happened in your career that I think is really most unusual for a singer. You shifted in your career from being a soprano to being a mezzo-soprano. Did your voice physically change? Did your voice shift?
Well, this has always been a point of contention as to whether I was really born with this sound, except that it didn't come out until I was past 30 years of age. I had an unusually wide range as a youngster, already at perhaps at 12 years of age. And when I started as a soprano, the extension was so big that it wasn't difficult for me to be classified as a dramatic soprano. But there was an interesting observation made by several conductors. When I sang Fidelio at the Met with Bruno Walter, I was barely 21, and the critics the next day said, "We don't know whether this is..." No, they said, "We do know it's an enormous talent. We cannot tell yet whether this is a soprano with a tremendous bottom or whether this is a mezzo-soprano with a very big top. Time will tell." Well, I had sung 14 years as a soprano, and my voice kept getting darker and darker and darker. And I had to make a decision as to where the sound really lay. And I took an experimental year to do it, and there was no question that the voice dropped in that experiment, rethinking everything about singing and a completely new way of singing with another teacher. The voice, what came out of the bottom of the barrel was like wine that was lying there for many years being unused. And suddenly the high part of the voice became even freer because I was not taxing the upper part of the voice. I was using the middle and lower part of the voice, which was, well, it's the sound you're actually listening to right now. It's the speaking voice I've always had. But I had, of course, the benefit of having two careers. Several conductors, notably Clemens Krauss, in Bayreuth, when I was singing Sieglinde, said that he thought I was a mezzo and told that to Wilhelm Wagner. Much earlier than that, in a very short conversation with one of the great giants of all time, Otto Klemperer, he said to me quietly one day, "I wouldn't be surprised that if you change repertory someday." Now, the story of Otto Klemperer is interesting because, as you know, my colleague and partner, Mr. Schultz, is his son, Werner Klemperer.
Right, your partner in cabaret.
Exactly.
Now, let me ask you, when you started thinking that maybe you were really now a mezzo instead of a soprano, was that upsetting for a while?
It was a crisis.
I'll bet.
I think I wept for a year. Then cleansed my eyes in the morning and started singing again, not because I didn't think I could conquer it or that it wasn't so. I really believed it. It's only that in the 14 years, I had started when I was 18, and we were now talking about being 30, 31, 32 years of age. At this point, thinking about giving up 40 parts that I had sung, which is more than a lifetime's work, done in 14 years, and keeping only one role, Carmen, which I had already sung as a soprano, was catastrophic in my head that in the next 15 years, I would not only double or triple my repertory, but go through a period of learning where I had really thought deep in my heart that maybe 50% of what I had already learned would serve me the rest of my life. And I found myself in new studies for the next 20 years. And in the end, toward the close of the operatic chapter of my career, I had sung 81 parts.
What are the differences in the kind of roles you end up singing when you're a mezzo from what you'd sing as a soprano?
Well, as a soprano, I sang mostly only the heroines. And they were the heavies in any case, the Toscas and the Fidelios and the Santuzzas. But as a mezzo, I think that the mezzo-soprano repertory really gave me the opportunity to exploit everything I wanted to do as an actress on stage. And the gamut was so great, from Carmen to Delilah to Frauenschatten, to the glamorous Eboli, to Clytemnestra, to Herodias, to the Frauenschatten, to all of the Wagnerian parts, and then to a high comedy like Mr. Squickley in Falstaff, to doing a male role like Orlovsky in Fledermaus, to then doing one of the great challenges on the operatic stage, the role of Pique Dame. The Queen of Spades is probably one of the great challenges of all time for any actress, whether she sings or speaks. And if she has to sing and does sing well, I think the challenge is twice as great.
You explained to us early on that you feel that you never really retired from opera, but you did go through a period of not singing very much, on the other hand.
Several years.
When you weren't singing a lot, did you still go to the opera? I know a lot of people go through a period of withdrawal when they stop or temporarily stop doing what they've done for many years.
Well, I have to tell you that I never had time to go to the opera when I was singing. I was on the other side of the footlights most of the time. It was very rare that I was in the public. Very. I was just too busy. And even in those years, in the very productive years when I was on the stage, which was 40 years, when I did go to the opera, it was to hear a colleague I adored, an opera I may never hear again, to see a production done by a great stage director from whom I could learn. In other words, I went because I wanted to, not because I was a regular opera goer. I was not. I was an opera singer, not a goer. I was a theater goer. I went to see the things that would bring me other facets of my profession. After I left the operatic stage, which was a year after the centennial of the Met, 1984, I must tell you that I went to the opera only to hear a particular person that I might not have heard in the role, or a conductor that I wanted to hear or know, a piece I knew I may never see again. And one of the reasons is that, of course, this sounds a little bit, it always sounds like sour grapes when somebody who's not practicing in the profession says, but it was so much better then, and it's not like that now. There's an excellent critic these days whose name is Will Crutchfield, whom I admire very, very much and whom I read, who knows a great deal about singing. And he has given me leave to speak. He finally allowed me to release some of the pent-up feelings I had about what he called burnout at the opera. And I am so sickened and so discouraged by the way the operatic voice is now being used as an industry. And that's one of the reasons I don't go so much anymore. Well, now, of course, I'm completely tied into cabaret, and my going anywhere is going to my dressing room. And the one thing I wanted to say, if we have a few seconds left.
We have 2 seconds left, honestly.
2 seconds left is to say that the difference between the opera and Broadway is that I have met in this company probably a group of people that have become one of the most endearing ensembles I have ever worked with in my life. The singers, the dancers, all my colleagues, and the stars.
That's wonderful to hear, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Regina Resnick is now performing in the Broadway revival of Cabaret. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Alan Toussaint. For close to 30 years, he's been a force in New Orleans rhythm and blues, writing songs like Working in a Coal Mine and Mother-in-Law, and running one of New Orleans' major recording studios, where he's worked with Dr. John, Paul McCartney, The Band, and others. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, pianist and composer Rand Blake talks about his music, music influenced by Bela Bartok, Thelonious Monk, and Alfred Hitchcock. Blake heads the third stream department at the New England Conservatory of Music. Also, rock historian Ed Ward says San Francisco wasn't the only hotbed of psychedelic rock in the 60s. He profiles the Texas-based band Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators. And humorist Alice Kahn explains why when she recently moved, she got more than a new address. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. While workers try to clean up a 65-mile oil slick on the Monongahela and Ohio Rivers, efforts are also underway to restore water supplies to thousands of Pittsburgh-area residents. They've been forced to buy bottled water or hauled buckets from tank trucks. The oil slick is expected to reach Wheeling, West Virginia by morning, and Wheeling City Manager Mike Now says precautions have been taken.
You know, we do feed from the Ohio River. We are on the normal flow, and that's the course that the spill is taking. There's every indication that it will enter our system. We just want to be sure that when it gets here, we have some plan in effect to deal with it, to try to minimize the impact that it has on our community.
Now says the city is running lines to nearby communities to pump water into Wheeling. The EPA says there's no way to know how far the spill will travel through the river system, perhaps hundreds of miles. Accused terrorist Abbas Hamadi has denied participating in the kidnapping of two West Germans in Lebanon. Hamadi made the statement today during the opening of his trial on charges of kidnapping, intimidation, and the illegal transportation of explosives. Deidre Berger reports from Dusseldorf.
The thin, heavily bearded Abbas Hamadi refused to discuss the charges against him in his trial opening. The 29-year-old restricted his answers to questions about his personal background. The state prosecutor charges that Abbas Hamadi helped kidnap two West Germans to try and prevent the West German government from extraditing his brother Mohammed to the U.S. Mohammed, who is awaiting trial in a West German jail, is wanted by the U.S. on hijacking charges. Bond turned down the extradition request in June, and one of the West German hostages was released in September. Today in court, Abbas Hamadi appealed to the hijackers to release the remaining hostage. Hamadi has joint Lebanese-West German citizenship and spoken fluent German today, displaying a great deal of humor in his answers to the judge's questions. A six-week cross-examination of witnesses begins tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Dusseldorf.
In Cairo, Egypt today, police clashed with stone-throwing university students protesting Israel's clampdown on Palestinians in the occupied territories of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Less than 2 miles away, lawyers burned the Israeli and American flags at their association headquarters in Cairo. Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers fired on hundreds of Arab rioters on the Gaza Strip today, killing at least one and wounding eight. 5 soldiers were also injured. Gusting winds drove frigid Canadian air across the U.S. last night, setting few records but dropping temperatures in many Midwest cities to the lowest they've been in 2 or 3 years. The state of New York was also hard hit, as John Kalish reports.
In upstate New York, the Arctic air sent temperatures plunging to minus 40 degrees with the wind chill factored in. The Buffalo area got more than a foot of snow today, forcing several school districts to cancel classes. The mercury fell into the single digits in the New York metropolitan area this morning, freezing roadways and causing a second day of subway failures. The National Weather Service urged the elderly and the infirm to stay indoors for the next few days. Frigid conditions are expected to taper off just slightly on Thursday. With westerly winds gusting up to 50 miles per hour, homeless New Yorkers are seeking refuge in city shelters. Last night, 10,000 homeless people stayed inside the shelters. There's a possibility that more snow will fall here on Friday. For National Public Radio, this is John Kalish in New York.
The greatest scorer in college basketball history, Pete Maravich, died today after collapsing during a pickup basketball game in California. Maravich was a former star at Louisiana State and spent most of his NBA career with the Atlanta Hawks and New Orleans Jazz. He was 40 years old. Stock prices rose for the second straight day today. The Dow Jones Industrial closed 16 points higher. I'm Dale Willman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a profile of Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators. This psychedelic group achieved a certain notoriety in the 60s because of their music, and well, because of Rocky. Ed says that today collectors may spend $100 or more for some of the old Elevator albums to hear songs like this one, Fire Engine.
Travel and tell people I live in Austin, Texas, the Americans always want to know how Willie Nelson's doing, and the Europeans want to know about Rocky Erickson, what he's really like. I always tell them the story about Rocky talking to the frozen food in Safeway, although it's about 2 years old. It makes them happy. Not many people realize it, but Texas was about co-equal with California in the psychedelic revolution of the mid-60s. While Californians toasted their brains with LSD, in Texas, Mexican pot was cheap, and you could order legal peyote cactus from a ranch in South Texas. The main difference between the scenes was that Texas, the home of President Lyndon Johnson, cracked down on its underground a lot harder. And while the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead were making the headlines, Texas produced the 13th Floor Elevators. They started out in San Marcos, where LBJ had gone to college, as a frat band with the unfortunate name of the Spades. A local entrepreneur recorded their best song, You're Gonna Miss Me, which we just heard, and the song was a modest local hit. Then Leland Rogers, brother of Kenny, who at the time was leading a jazz trio in Houston, heard them. He invited them to be the first to record on his International Artists label. By that time, the Spades had been investigating various chemicals and were known as the 13th Floor Elevators, and this suited Leland Rogers fine. Psychedelic music was the wave of the future, and he was ready to record these boys, weird as they were. He even managed to turn You're Gonna Miss Me into a modest national hit and followed it up with an album whose cover, featuring pyramids, eyeballs, and squiggly stuff, is a masterpiece of naive psychedelia. The Elevators toured and often played San Francisco's Fillmore and Avalon ballrooms. Seeing what was happening out there, they began to be more brazen and overt about their weirdness. It all came to a sudden end when Rocky was arrested for drugs and sentenced to one of Texas' most notorious hellholes, the Rusk State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. He spent years there, getting shock treatment and being fed drugs. When he was finally released, nobody expected much. But some old friends believed, and one was Doug Somm, former leader of the Sir Douglas Quintet. He heard some of Rocky's new songs and loved them, and in the mid-70s released Starry Eyes by Rocky with his new group, Bleeb Alien.
I'm
Oh, sure, the other side was about working in the Kremlin with a two-headed dog. But the point is, Rocky was back, and just as the punk movement that had picked up on a lot of the elevator stuff was gathering steam. Fire Engine, which we heard at the top of this piece, became the theme song of the New York band Television. Rocky's a big hero in Europe now, and he's writing some weird and funny songs. So what if he sleeps on his roof or talks to the frozen food?
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Rocky Erickson's latest album with his current band, The Explosives, is called Casting the Runes. It's on the British label 5 Hours Back. This is Fresh Air. Rand Blake is an idiosyncratic pianist and composer who once worried that he didn't fit into the worlds of jazz or classical music. Since childhood, one of the places he felt most comfortable in was the darkened movie theater, watching suspense and mystery films, which he continues to pay homage to in his own music. Since 1973, Blake has headed the Third Stream Studies Department at the New England Conservatory of Music, a department created by Blake's mentor, Gunther Schuller, to embrace music influenced by both classical and jazz forms. Schuller has produced a new compact disc of Blake's piano solos, and there's another new album featuring Blake and three musicians who have studied with him. One is the tenor saxophonist Ricky Ford. That quintet album is titled Short Life of Barbara Monk. The title track is dedicated to the daughter of jazz pianist and composer Thelonious Monk. She died within 2 years of her father's death. I asked Rand Blake if Thelonious Monk's music and personality helped give Blake the license to express his own eccentricities.
His Charles Ivesian tone clusters, the darkness, the wry humor, inspired me so much. And I realized that jazz had flexibility, as did some of Ives' own music and the best of Hollywood mystery music. And I realized here was a pianist I could follow, because until then, jazz pianists had left me cold, other than maybe Mary Lou doing the blues. But really, the piano was not the instrument that I chose to listen to. It was jazz singers and gospel choirs.
Was it hard to find a place for yourself in the jazz world when you were starting out?
Very much so. I didn't expect to suddenly find employment and get a large audience, but I had a very lonely existence because my peers did not accept what I wanted to do. And when I had been studying with Gunther 2-3 years, he said, "Perhaps, Ran, your third stream. Did it ever occur to you that maybe you're not a jazz musician?" In the early 60s, it was very, very hard to know what I was doing. And I at least wanted a label. I had to have a label, Terry. At that point in time in history and in my young years, it was very important to know what I was doing.
So when you thought that you should have the label of jazz, what were some of the things that didn't fit about your playing?
I did not hear and conceive in bebop. I did the blues and gospel, but I didn't feel comfortable in ensembles. A lot of the repertoire I didn't like. I found the horn people were doing licks. There was not enough silence. So those are five things already.
When Gunther Schuller coined the term third stream, it was meant to describe a kind of music that was influenced by both jazz and classical music. You've headed the third stream department at the New England Conservatory of Music since 1973. Do you feel like you've redefined the meaning of third stream?
Yes, before I talk about how I maybe defined it in the department, I couldn't play anything else. So he felt I was also authentic, and that's what I wanted to try to capture. And I said, if everybody has to blend jazz and classical, which might have been my background, that would also bring a lot of unnatural feeling in. So I said, why does it only have to be contemporary jazz and avant-garde classical? Why could it not be somebody from Uganda that likes the fado in Portugal? Wouldn't that be a blend? So we extended it to include ethnic music of all kinds, and we also, instead of third stream music, period, a noun, we said third streaming or streaming, the art of fusing.
You have a Sephardic tune that is featured on your new album, Short Life of Barbara Monk. Is this to you part of what third stream is, borrowing and learning from other musics from around the world?
I think it can be. The piece you're speaking about, Terry, is Una Matica de Ruda. I don't think that doing a number and suddenly adding a sitar or a Japanese instrument automatically makes it third stream. But then, of course, we could... is it important whether it's third stream or not? In fact, even jazz was third stream at one time, the blend. So I love the music, and I hope I didn't destroy it, and I hope I kept some of the Arabic flavor. And that was what was important to me, and not whether it was third stream. Our 50s, we have to have the music that carries our name, and I don't think it's important if it's jazz, Sephardic, third stream, classical. It's, to me, a way of approaching music and studying music and learning more than a body of work. That's what I feel about third stream now.
You've always played music from film scores, and many of your own compositions have been inspired by movies that you've seen. A lot of people who go to the movies don't pay that much attention to the movie music. When did movie music really first get to you?
In 1946, when I saw Spiral Staircase. And then, of course, there was Marlon Brando's movie Wild One with Keith Stevens.
RCA has just reissued on compact disc your very first recording session. And on that album is your recording with singer Gene Lee of David Raskin's theme from the film Laura. Is there an image from that film that was in your mind when you were recording that song?
Yes, there is. And that image of Dana Andrews looking at Gene Turney's portrait while he's pouring another scotch and absolutely falling in love with a portrait of a woman who's supposedly dead.
Laura is the face in the misty light. Footsteps
that you hear down the hall, the laugh that floats on a summer night that you can never
It was finding Third Stream music that gave you a place to perform without feeling like you didn't fit in. Is that what you want to give back to students now?
Yes, and it was particularly important 15 or 20 years ago. Now the field is much more tolerant of composers who are writing different kinds of music that have moments of jazz or Polynesian music, but it's not been so for performers. Where do students learn to be professional, as there are not places to sit in for third stream music like there was for jazz 30 years ago? And I think what we do at New England Conservatory Music in the third stream department really does help confront and answer this age-old problem.
Pianist and composer Ran Blake. From one of his new recordings, Painted Rhythms, here's Maple Leaf Rag. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Oh, we're following the good day the dollar had. Also, it's inspired the lowering of the dollar over the years, now brought about a price increase announced by Sony of America. Also, news of the Monongahela River oil spill, a profile of a gang member from East Los Angeles, and an interesting take on the new movie Broadcast News.
Who's reviewing it?
Well, nobody's exactly reviewing it, but we're talking to Daniel Shore about it, who's lived through a lot of television news in his day, and who says it was a good movie, but not the morality play that he'd expected it to be.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Humorist Alice Kahn joins us today with some reflections on a recent change in her life and the highs and lows that have followed.
Am I in paradise yet? I just moved from the block in Berkeley, California, where I've lived for 20 years, to another house 3 miles away. 20 years in boxes. Was it a midlife crisis or a good idea? In the middle of packing box number 30, my daughter Hannah asks, "Tell me again why we're doing this, Mommy?" It seemed like a good idea at the time. The new house is bigger in a quieter place, far from the store, the traffic, far from everything except nature. You know, deer, raccoons, skunks, owls, enormous redwood trees. As soon as we bring our belongings to the new house, one neighbor arrives to tell us which tree to remove. Another handsome couple politely asks if their nude sunbathing will bother our children. Out back, we hear a distant guitar. A man is doing nude Tai Chi as his girlfriend plays Guantanamera. Welcome to California. We're drained. We've run the gauntlet of real estate torture. We've been buyers and sellers. We've visited title companies and loan officers and placed our initials next to an endless line of X's which stand for, "Okay, take all my money." We've moved up, and we ought to be in homeowner heaven. Yet everyone who checks the place out has an idea on how to make it better. We could paint the kitchen. We could refinish the floors. We could landscape the yard. One landscaper told me it's the worst yard he's ever seen, and he wouldn't touch it for less than $25,000. We could get rugs. We could get rattan furniture. We could get a microwave. We should get a new roof. Only problem is we just spent our wad and quadrupled our mortgage payments. Hannah asks, "When are we going to our real house?" I know what she means. Every night I wake up at 3 a.m. and think, "This is a very nice place, but it's time to go home." We did it for the children. No, we did it to get away from the children. We've got teenagers coming. We've got to take cover. The house has what they call in real estate speak, good separation. We did it because the trouble with staying in one place too long is that you notice all the changes and they piss you off. More traffic, more cars. We moved to get a parking place. I thought I would die in the old house. It was the first single-family house I ever lived in. It was the American dream, to live in a place with an upstairs and a downstairs and a yard and the oak hall tree that we found and refinished and mounted. The new owner came in with her personal carpenter and looked at our hall tree and said, "We'll yank that out first thing." Then she'll go over the walls with a blowtorch and really fix the place up. Now I know why God invented real estate people, to keep buyers and sellers apart. I think of my late mother making the steerage journey from Suwalk, Poland to America, America. Now I come by Datsun wagon to the hills of California, only to suffer nature shock. It's too pretty around here. We moved to be good Americans. We did it because it's our God-given duty to acquire more debt. We did it because the average American moves 11 times in a lifetime. I've moved 9. That gives me 2 more turns before I head up to that mansion in the sky.
Alice Kahn is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Her latest book is a collection of memoirs and essays titled My Life as a Gal. She spoke to us from Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley.
Sincero, de donde crece la palma. Yo soy un hombre sincero.
Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Susi Orbach and Louise Eichenbaum, two feminist psychotherapists who have co-authored a new book about envy and competition in women's friendships. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new recording featuring flutist Fenwick Smith, playing music by Aaron Copland and Aaron Foote. And our urban legends expert Jan Harald Brunvand will explore a popular misconception about the poinsettia plant, that it is poisonous or toxic. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton and Janine Colgren-Miller. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.